Our next speaker, Bertha Lujan, is one of Mexico's foremost critics of corporate globalization and neoliberalism. She helped form the outstanding main independent union in Mexico, the Frente Auténtico del Trabajo. Yeah. And the union has over 17,000 affiliates throughout Mexico. It's organizing and educating people and carrying on vital and important work. Bertha is also a leader in the Mexico Action Network on Free Trade that was organized to deal with the disaster perpetrated by NAFTA. So we look forward to hearing your words.
Agradezco mucho a los organizadores de este evento que forma parte de esta campaña en Washington por permitirnos participar en esta importante lucha.
Thank you very much to the organizers of this event that's taking place in the context of all that's going on in Washington now and for inviting us to participate.
Por tener el privilegio de escuchar testimonios como los compañeros de Indonesia, de Guatemala.
It was a privilege for me to be able to listen to the other participants like those from Indonesia and Guatemala.
Pero también de poder compartir la mesa con estas mujeres que están aquí hoy como presentadoras. Difícilmente en eventos así somos más mujeres que hombres los que estamos en esto.
And it's also a pleasure to be able to share the main table here with so many women. It's not often that there are so many women who are allowed to sit at the main table.
He sabido que las causas de la crisis de la deuda de los ochentas tuvo como causa principal o causa primaria el aumento de los intereses.
It has been brought to my attention. I've known that the principal causes of the crisis, the debt crisis of the 1980s, was the rise in interest rates.
En 1981, los Estados Unidos aumentaron las tasas nominales de interés en un 20%.
In 1981, the United States raised the basic interest rates by 20%.
Se esperaba que estas tasas bajaron y bajaron las tasas nominales, pero no así las tasas reales de interés.
So that while some of these interest rates did come down thereafter, as was hoped, the real interest rates did not come down.
De 75 a 79, los países en desarrollo pagaban 0.5% de intereses de la deuda.
From 1975 to 79, the countries in the process of development were paying 0.5% on the interest.
De 80 a 94, esta tasa había aumentado al 8.3%.
From 1980 through to 1994, the interest rate being paid was 8.3%.
Es fácil pensar entonces la crisis en la que entraron los países más endeudados del orbe, fundamentalmente los países en vías de desarrollo, los países del sur.
And this explains a large contributory factor to the crisis of the 80s and into the 90s when the debt crisis got worse.
México tuvo el horror de inaugurar la crisis de la deuda en 1982.
Mexico is known to be the country that in 1982 initiated the so-called debt crisis.
Al caer en un proceso de moratoria técnica, se le llamó, de imposibilidad de pago de la deuda.
That was when Mexico found itself in a situation where it was not possible to pay off the debt.
Este fue la culminación de un proceso de endeudamiento acelerado y rapidísimo.
And it was from 1982 forward where we entered into an accelerated process of the debt increasing.
Que incrementó la deuda externa de nuestro país, que en 64 era de 2.300 millones de dólares. $2,300 millones.
Así, 2,300.
So in 1974, the debt was 2,300. 2,300
millones de dólares.
$2,300,000 of debt.
Millones. Para convertirlo en 82, en 86,000 millones de dólares.
And then by the time, I got the earlier figures wrong, but by the time of 1982, the debt had gone up to $86 billion.
En solo 18 años, nuestro país pasó de ser un país que aparentemente era autosuficiente financieramente a un país altamente endeudado.
Brief summary, not to get too wrong with the figures. The figures went up from over an 18-year period from about $2 billion to $86 billion, and it turned Mexico from a country that was basically financially self-sufficient into a financially dependent country.
Después del 82 vinieron los planes de reestructuración y renegociación de la deuda.
That's when from 82 to 92.
Después de 82.
And so from 1982 forward is when Mexico starts to fall under the rubric of the IMF structural adjustment programs and all the terms of conditionality.
El plan Baker en 85.
1985 was imposed upon us the plan Baker, the Baker plan.
El plan Baker B en 87.
1987 was the plan Baker plan B.
El plan Brady en 89.
1989 was the Brady plan.
Y el salvamento del tesoro de los Estados Unidos en 95.
And it was in 1995 the so-called bailing out of our economy by the US Treasury.
Para este año donde se produce nuevamente una crisis de moratoria de la deuda mexicana, ya la deuda alcanzaba los 150,000 millones de dólares.
So this year we're already once again finding ourselves in the crisis of not being able to pay off the debt, and we have an accumulated debt now of $150 billion.
El 61% del Producto Interno Bruto.
Which is approximately 61% of our GMP.
Solo en este año el país pagó por amortización e intereses de la deuda.
So in this year alone, our country has paid off on interest payments alone.
El salario mínimo anual de 25 millones de mexicanos.
So in this year alone, we have already paid off on the interest of the debt alone, the equivalent of the minimum salary of 25 million Mexican workers.
Y viene el círculo vicioso, pagamos, nos endeudamos más.
This is the vicious circle. The more we pay, the more the debt goes up.
Pedimos prestado para pagar.
We ask for a new loan to pay off the debt.
La deuda eterna.
The eternal debt.
Y los recursos y la riqueza de los mexicanos hacia los bancos internacionales.
And what we're giving over is all of our natural and human resources to the international banks.
Y las posibilidades de bienestar de la gente en las manos de los acreedores.
And it is the creditors who hold in their hands the possible well-being of the Mexican people.
Estamos en el año 2000.
Now we are in the year 2000.
La deuda mexicana externa es de más de 150 mil millones de dólares.
Our debt has already gone over now $150 billion.
Y si le sumamos la inversión extranjera en bolsa, esta llega a ser de 215 mil millones de dólares.
Y eso es deuda privada combinada con deuda. If one combines the private debt with the public debt that our country owes, it is now over $215 billion.
Tenemos finalmente todo el futuro para pagar, dirán los acreedores.
But we have a long future ahead of us to be able to pay off all of the creditors.
Pero con los planes de reestructuración de la deuda vinieron las políticas de austeridad.
And so at the same time that were imposed on us, the structural adjustment programs came with them, the so-called austerity program.
Las políticas de ajuste estructural.
Which and the structural adjustment programs themselves are austerity packages.
Después de la crisis de 1982, el Fondo Monetario Internacional y el Banco Mundial dictaron sus reglas.
So from 1982 forward, we have been living under rules that have been dictated to us by the IMF and the World Bank.
Privatización de las empresas públicas.
Privatized public enterprises.
Desregulación para el libre paso de capitales.
deregulate the borders so that international capital can move freely.
Para el libre paso de mercancías y de servicios.
Take away controls so that services and commerce products can pass freely across our borders.
Disminución del gasto público y fundamentalmente del gasto social.
So decrease public spending and with particular emphasis on decreasing social spending.
Gasto social, que quiere decir educación, salud, vivienda.
Social spending, we're talking about health, education and housing spending.
Y para cerrar con broche de oro, apertura comercial.
And then the tie that binds us all together is the opening of our economy to international investment.
No es casual, por lo tanto, que en 85 nosotros entráramos al GATT, hoy OMC.
It's not surprising that in this process that Mexico in 1985 entered into GATT, which has then become the WTO, the World Trade Organization.
Y que en 1994 se haya consolidado el modelo con la firma del Tratado de Libre Comercio de América del Norte con Estados Unidos y con Canadá.
It was in 1994 that the process was completed when Mexico signed the NAFTA agreement with the United States and Canada.
Tenemos 20 años, casi 20 años de políticas de austeridad.
We're now going on over 20 years, or almost 20 years, of austerity policies.
6 años de NAFTA.
6 years of NAFTA.
Y tenemos los efectos y los impactos y los resultados a la vista.
And anyone who goes to Mexico or studies it can see the results of all of these
policies. Un nivel de endeudamiento que nos coloca como de los principales países deudores del mundo.
The debt, we are one of the highest indebted countries in the world.
El desmantelamiento de la planta productiva nacional.
The national capacity to produce goods has gone down.
Por la desaparición de miles de micro y pequeñas empresas que no han podido competir frente a la entrada de productos extranjeros, fundamentalmente de Estados Unidos.
Thousands and thousands of small and micro enterprises, businesses have folded and collapsed because they cannot compete with international business coming in principally from the United States.
Empleo precario a través de las maquiladoras como opción de empleo.
Then we have the option that one of the only valid options for work is the maquilador industry, and that industry is is work in very precarious conditions.
Somos 100 millones de mexicanos.
We are in Mexico a population of 100 million.
La mitad de la población, 50 millones, están en la pobreza.
50% of the population lives in conditions of poverty.
Tenemos 26 millones en pobreza extrema.
26% of the population lives in conditions of extreme poverty.
De los 40 millones de personas en edad de trabajar, la mitad están en el empleo informal, esto es, no tienen empleo estable.
Of 40 million people who are considered to be of an age to be employed, 50% of those are in the informal sector, the work sector that provides no job security or salary security.
Y los salarios generales y industriales siguen en picada. A partir de 82 se inicia la caída salarial y más o menos acumula para el 2000 70% de pérdida salarial.
So between 1982 and the year 2000, if one takes the general farm worker or the general city worker, urban worker, the general salary has fallen across the country by about 70%, the value of the salary.
El salario mínimo general en México es de $4 diarios por 8 horas de trabajo.
Minimum salary now in Mexico is $4 a day for an 8-hour day of work.
Eso es lo que cuesta un kilo de carne.
2 pounds of meat costs $4.
Frente al nivel de pobreza que estamos acumulando, hay muchos que han ganado en el país y fuera del país.
But in the situation, there are many who have benefited from the situation.
Como sucede en el resto de los países, pocos han ganado con este modelo.
And this is common in many countries where Mexicans, whether they're inside the country or outside the country, have
Los tenemos muy bien ubicados.
We know who they are, we know where they are.
En el caso de México, son unas cuantas familias las que han pasado al club de los grandes ricos en el mundo.
In Mexico, there's a small number of families who have now joined that exclusive club of the richest people in the world.
Tenemos también los nombres de las 300 empresas exportadoras que concentran el 70% 1% de las exportaciones en México.
We have the names of some 300 businesses that are the principal businesses that are involved in the exportation of goods from Mexico that make up over 70% of Mexico's exportations.
Y sabemos también que los especuladores han ganado.
We also know that all the speculators and go-betweens have benefited from all this.
Pero esta situación que describo es un diagnóstico que ha tenido una respuesta.
There has been a response to this situation that I've been describing to you.
Hay un conjunto importante de organizaciones y de movimientos que han rechazado y han respondido a esta política concreta.
There is a wide movement of different types of organizations that have provided responses to this and have been confronting the situation.
En 1988, la gente votó por un candidato de oposición, el ingeniero Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, en contra del PRI gobierno.
In 1988, in the general presidential elections, the people of Mexico voted for the PRD opposition candidate, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, and that was a vote against the reigning PRI. Party.
Rechazando al gobierno que había venido imponiendo durante todos estos años estas políticas económicas.
This was a rejection of 6 years of austerity and structural adjustment policies that the PRI government had been imposing.
El primero de enero de 1994 estalla la lucha zapatista en el sureste del país, en Chiapas.
In January 1st, 1994, the Zapatista uprising broke out in the southern province state of Chiapas.
Reivindicando la lucha de 13 millones de indígenas que viven en situación de extrema pobreza en el país.
The Zapatista struggle in particular is focusing in on the struggle and the rights of some 13 million indigenous people in Mexico.
Y en 1999 estalla la huelga en la Universidad Nacional de México, que es la universidad más grande de América Latina.
In 1999 was the student strike that took place in the UNAM, which is the biggest public university in the Americas.
En la cual los estudiantes exigen educación pública y gratuita.
The primary demand of this student strike is to demand public, free university education for all people.
Pero también ha crecido en México la conciencia de que es necesario luchar fuera del país.
Also at the same time, the awareness in Mexico has increased as to the importance of struggling outside the country as well.
Y con esto termino porque ya sonó la campana.
Well, I have to end with this because I heard the little bell go off.
Hay una conciencia de que es necesario cambiar las cosas en México, que es necesaria la democracia en México, un nuevo gobierno.
We're very clear that we have to struggle inside Mexico to create a real democracy.
Pero que también es necesario influir sobre las instituciones multilaterales o internacionales que están influyendo en nuestra vida.
But at the same time, we're very clear that we also have to influence and have an impact on the multilateral institutions and the international institutions that are having such an impact on, inside our country.
Por eso estamos aquí. Hay muchos que quisieran estar aquí, pero que no pueden estar.
That's why we're here. There were many more than me that would like to be here, but they couldn't come.
Pero traemos con ellos las cuatro demandas que son demandas de muchos de los movimientos que están hoy aquí en Washington.
But I have brought with me four demands that is sort of a demands of many different groups.
Es necesaria la cancelación de la deuda de los países del sur.
Cancel the debt of the countries of the south.
Ya terminó, ¿no?
Tres puntos más.
Es necesario democratizar las instituciones internacionales y multilaterales.
We must democratize the international institutions and the multilateral institutions.
Es necesario acabar con las políticas de austeridad que han llevado a la pobreza extrema a nuestras poblaciones y a nuestras naciones.
We must put immediate end to the austerity programs that have increased poverty in our countries.
Y es necesario un cambio político a nivel mundial, pero por gobiernos que realmente aseguren a la gente sustentabilidad y distribución justa del ingreso.
And we need political change in governments around the world so that their main policies to look after the well-being of their citizens and get involved in serious programs of income redistribution.
Porque nosotros somos la esperanza, y hay esperanza porque nosotros estamos aquí.
We are the hope, and there is hope because here we are.
Our next speaker is going to talk more about cancellation of the debt. Dennis Brutus is a founder and a leader in Jubilee 2000 South Africa. And he is a former political prisoner there for 6 years. He served in jail on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. He's been an activist in crucial and important campaigns. For example, the divestment campaign that many of you perhaps participated in, and the Olympic boycott. But he's also got strong academic credentials, and he can tell us about those as well. He was professor of emeritus in African literature at the University of Pittsburgh. So, Dennis, we look forward to hearing about canceling the debt.
Thank you, and my thanks to the International Forum on Globalization for giving us this opportunity to get together, to reinforce each other, to build our strength, our energy, our courage to go forward. And of course we ought to thank the Church for giving us this opportunity to use this magnificent facility. And indeed, the churches throughout the world are playing a significant part in the movement that I'm going to address or discuss with you, the Jubilee 2000 movement. I thought I would just tell you what it's trying to do, what it has done, what it's composed of, and where we go from here. And that surely is a question we should all be asking. Having built this tremendous momentum, having come all the way from the West Coast and Seattle West, where we now are in Seattle East, it is time to ask who we are and where we're going and what we want to do. So those are the things I will talk about and keep it fairly brief. But I want to remind you to start that the IMF and the World Bank have had a devastating impact all over the world, but very particularly in the continent I come from, Africa. And so it was a sense of enormous responsibility that I try to convey to you the suffering of the people of Africa as a consequence of the policies of the World Bank and the IMF, and to focus narrowly on just one aspect of it, the question of debt, the enormous burden of debt carried by African countries. The last figure I've seen is a total of $350 billion owed by the countries of Africa, a debt they will have no hope of ever being able to repay, but a debt which each year they must continue to service and at least pay the interest on that debt. And in many cases, the 20% which goes to service the debt exceeds the amount of the budget that is devoted to education and health. But because they are required to make the bank a priority creditor, to make the debt a priority, social services, the schools, the houses, hospitals, water, sanitation, all these must wait until first the obligations to the debt are met. And so that's what I'm going to talk about in the context of Jubilee 2000. And as you know, the concept originates in the Bible. The churches have been very vigorous on this issue, and I'm glad to say that includes, in the case of South Africa, not only the Archbishop of Cape Town, who has succeeded Desmond Tutu. Archbishop Ndungani is, together with myself, one of the patrons and founders of Jubilee 2000 South Africa. We also have the Chief Rabbi. We have the Chief Imam as patrons of our campaign, so that it is very broadly based. But the South African Jubilee 2000 takes its direction from the Bible, the book of Leviticus, as of Deuteronomy, which talks about at the end of a cycle, a period of years, 50, 100, in this case 2000, of making a new beginning, of forgiving one's debts, of canceling the debts, starting all over and sounding the jubel, the horn of the jubilee to announce that new beginning. And that's what we're asking for in the year 2000. And that's the demand with which we're going to confront the G7 when they have their next summit in July in Okinawa. And I will return to that. But here in the United States, as you know, there's a Jubilee 2000 movement. It is one of the movements now in 65 countries across the world. And these countries have combined on this demand, have organized protests. With last year in Cologne, when the G7 or the G7 and a half was there after they decided to invite the Russians, we presented a petition with 17 million signatures demanding the cancellation of the debt. And what happened in Cologne last year when we put 40,000 people on the streets of Cologne, forming a human chain around the center where the heads of state of the G7, seven and a half, were meeting, was part of our action. As indeed, last week we had here in Washington. Many of you, I expect, were part of that. We created a human chain around the Capitol, symbolic of the chain of debt which strangles development. In many countries in the South, countries we used to refer to as the Third World, countries who are compelled to make the repayment of debt a priority and deny their own citizens the necessary social services. So that's part of it, but that's not all. Because the previous year, we were in Birmingham, in England, and there we put 70,000 people on the streets of the city with a special message of support addressed to them by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Catholic Cardinal of Britain, Basil Hume, who died shortly thereafter, the Chief Rabbi in Britain, all urging people to get to Birmingham and there to demonstrate their concern and their demand for the cancellation of debt. So this is what we do through Jubilee 2000, and many of you, I'm sure, are involved. But we've become a little more ambitious than that. Not only have we pulled together the countries of Africa, but we've gone ahead and worked with the countries of Asia, countries of America, to build a coalition around the demand for the cancellation of debt. We met in Cape Town to launch the Summit of Countries of Africa. There was a summit in Tegucigalpa in Honduras for the countries of America to come together and form their coalition. There was a summit in Bangkok in Asia to develop the same kind of unified position. And then in Gauteng, Johannesburg, we had what we call the South-South Summit, a combination of organizations from Asia, from Africa, from America, coming together. We even invited people from the North, because we know that we have allies in the North who support our demand, who are part of our struggle for a new and just society, an equitable society in which people all will have the right for a decent existence. And out of our South-South Summit in Gauteng, we hammered together what we called first an African consensus of the countries of Africa, then went further by the incorporation of the demands from Asia and Latin America. We were able to come up with what we call a people's consensus. And that consensus we are now in the process of defining even more precisely and offering it as an alternative to that bankrupt Washington consensus, which even its own proponents have confessed has been a disastrous failure. So there we are, building a new consensus, and it seems to me it is a consensus which will require not merely the countries of the South, not merely the countries of the Third World, but very particularly our allies in the Northern, the industrialized, the developed countries. We need them to reinforce our demand. And of course that demand is for the cancellation of debt. But we're not going to stop there. We're going to ask for the building of a new global economic architecture, a new just social order. And in that whole magnificent enterprise, we look forward to working with you in that undertaking. You've heard already in the speeches we've heard so far how devastating, how destructive, how inhumane are the policies of the World Bank and the IMF and the WTO. Well, as you know, in Seattle we said no to the WTO. We not only said it, but we delivered. We were able to demonstrate that with the will of the people and enough people on the streets of Seattle, we could say, no new round, no new millennial round. That was the slogan, and we stuck to it, and we made it work. But we also said, turn around, turn around, turn around. And what we were saying is, we reject the system which puts profits before people. We reject the system which puts corporate interest before human values, human rights. And on those positions we took a stand, and now we come to Washington, to Seattle East perhaps, and we say to the World Bank and to the IMF, no to your kind of corporate globalization. We want a new, a just, and an equitable society all over the world. And that's going to be our position. So as we move forward, I remind you that instead of bringing sustainable human development, the projects of the IMF and the World Bank all over the world, but particularly in Africa, have had devastating economic, social, and ecological consequences. And that is what we're taking a stand against. Where do we go from here? This is not entirely part of my brief. I now speak not for the International Forum of Globalization or any other organization, but in our informal discussion, we've talked about three possibilities for the future as we move forward to create the kind of world we are about to create. In May, early in May, and particularly around May Day, all across the United States, students and workers are coming together to challenge the sweatshops of the world and the consumerism which benefits from the exploitation of women and children in this country and in other parts of the world. So May is going to be a big time for us to move our energies forward, and particularly for cooperation between workers on the one hand, the trade unions, and all other organizations, churches, students, etc., in developing our energy. And then in July, when the G7, instead of Birmingham or Cologne, meets in some pleasantly inaccessible place where we will not be able to demonstrate and will not be able to make our voices heard, although remember, July is the deadline for the Jubilee 2000 demand for the cancellation of the debt. At that point, when we cannot get to Okinawa, the idea is that we will have our demonstrations, our rallies, our protests, wherever we are. And therefore, we should start organizing for them now. And the essence of all this, to conclude, is to realize that we cannot change the world, which is what we want to do, if we cannot do it from the grassroots up. And that is why we've got to talk about a movement which is a grassroots movement, but is also a global movement. And what we must now focus our attention on is a grassroots global movement. And let's hear it together. A grassroots global movement. That is what we need. Thank you.
We have a special treat for you. We have two speakers who are not listed on your program to provide additional information for us. Our first of the additional speakers is Kathy Totokin, who is the director of the U.S.-based National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Now, this is a nationwide alliance of immigrants, labor, human rights, religious, and other social and economic groups and activists. She's also a founder and member of the Migrant Rights International. Now, this is a global network which is actively working to promote the rights of all migrant workers. Kathy.
Thank you. You know, a colleague was reminding me that some 20 years ago, when many of us in the Filipino community here were fighting to oppose U.S. support of the Marcos dictatorship of the Philippines, that Walden Bello, who's going to be speaking here later, did what we consider to be some really groundbreaking work, exposing the role of the World Bank in the Philippines. So it's both inspiring and sobering that he's here today, that we're all here today, still attempting to do the same thing. And I think it reinforces the importance of continuity and commitment in this movement that we're building. Yesterday, a number of us working on questions of immigration and immigrant rights in the United States met to discuss what we might do as our commitment to preparations for the World Conference against racism, xenophobia, and other forms of intolerance that will be held in South Africa in August 2001. It's a very daunting task to consider the preparations for such an important venue, and we have some cynicism about the outcome of certainly of the United Nations deliberations. As we're looking back on the Beijing conference on women that took place in 1995, there were some very positive outcomes out of the UN deliberations. The Platform for Action was really a very important statement of the importance of recognizing gender across the board. But despite all of the very positive proposals that were embodied in that Platform for Action, 5 years later, we look at the impact of globalization and the incredible and devastating impact that it has had on women in particular around the world. And it's not news for most of us, I think, in the non-governmental movement, those of us who are activists. But without addressing the fundamental problems embodied within globalization, all of those positive steps that were represented in the Platform for Action out of Beijing appear very shallow, and they don't appear to hold much water, and they certainly don't hold much progress for advancing the rights of women. It's with that perspective that in looking at a conference like that which will address questions of racism and xenophobia, that we also understand that we need to thoroughly embody, and especially among non-governmental organizations and their participation in this conference, that we bring a clear message and some very fundamental principles and framework considering the role of globalization and how that has impacted questions of race and xenophobia around the world. We need strategies that clearly address the challenges of globalization, the importance of raising the question of human rights, and migration. Globalization is certainly the major contributing factor to the unprecedented migration now of over 130 million people around the world, including millions of people who are displaced within their own countries. So for those of us, certainly from the United States and worldwide, this is not an insignificant task to consider how we need to address this on the world stage. Within the United States, organizing for the conference also provides another unique opportunity, and that's for us to be able to bring together those of us who work on immigrant rights and racial justice and globalization, together with diverse communities of color, to consider the impact of globalization on our society, how racial stratification has become more entrenched given the domestic impact of globalization, how demographic change due to immigration has produced a more evident shift in the black-white paradigm that has often defined race relations in the United States, and to understand how this domestic impact of globalization has also exacerbated interracial tensions has also fed from within the United States, including broadly within the working class, anxieties and hostilities towards the foreign-born, the immigrants who are, in fact, a product of the globalization process. The World Conference will also provide a stage to address the conditions and challenges of the world's migrants, although it's still not clear how the conference will address the fundamental issues for migrants' rights. And these are certainly considerable challenges, again, given the numbers of migrants around the world, as globalization has proceeded, and I think I'm not going to repeat all of what has come before me in terms of testimony about conditions in Guatemala, in Mexico, in Indonesia. Economic, social breakdown, societies unable to provide for the more vulnerable sectors, armed conflict, including those that use ethnic and religious differences, can destroy and displace populations, and that is indeed taking place worldwide. The effects of structural adjustment programs, there are certainly more people in poverty with little or no social support. Migration does become a viable option, especially when you consider, in this modern era, advances in technology, travel on a plane, across the roads that have been constructed to support globalization. Migration is often a very logical and sometimes not a terribly difficult process for some people. The impacts are certainly enormous. Most migration takes place within the global south, where countries with few resources cannot assist new immigrants. The hostility towards foreigners, however, I think we can see a lot through the migration patterns that have taken place towards Europe, as well as to North America. Even though the United States receives just over 1% of the world's migrants, over 85% of those migrants are people of color. And that is certainly a factor which contributes to some very concerted support for policies to restrict immigration in this country, but I'm sure you're all aware of the restrictive policies that have been prevalent throughout Europe. In 1996, in the United States, immigration legislation coupled with welfare reform and other pieces of legislation really did transform the way in which the United States treats immigrants. It's led to greater restrictions on mobility. We can easily see some of the hypocrisy and tragedy out of immigration policy. An example of that is the fact that we've all seen how certain public figures are bending over backwards to ensure that Elian Gonzalez, the Cuban child, has a place within the United States. But I was just looking at a case the other day of a Mexican family, a family of four, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, father, mother, two children, were stopped by the Border Patrol. The parents were detained, arrested, handcuffed. A two-year-old child was also handcuffed. They were placed in the Border Patrol van. Because the parents were handcuffed, they could not hold on to the infant, who was left to roll around in the van as it proceeded. We can all imagine the horror of that family. But that's the kind of welcome that a Mexican child would receive. That's the kind of welcome that a Haitian child, in fact, a Haitian child wouldn't be allowed to step foot on the United States because they would locate the ship coming from Haiti and stop it and turn it back around. A Guatemalan child crossing the U.S.-Mexico border would receive the same kind of welcome. That's some of the hypocrisy of immigration policy, but I think we can see how it's important to look at that in the context of our challenge towards globalization, because migrants simply represent the internationalization of labor. They are indeed what we consider to be refugees of the global economy. And in this era of globalization, it's important that we struggle for an understanding of the need for rights for people on either side of the border, human rights for people regardless of citizenship, nationality, or immigration status. It was interesting to hear Kevin Donaher this morning refer to the notion of global citizenship. And in our movement, we always get a little anxious when people say citizen, because it's been a term that has been used so exclusively and so much tied to the rights of nationality that for people who are foreign-born, who don't lay claim to a certain national citizenship in the country in which they reside, or who are here without immigration status, it's just one more way to set that population aside, to add layers of persecution. On the other hand, it's a concept which should embody what is the future of this world. Immigration certainly isn't going to stop, and while it's unfortunate that people are often forced into patterns of migration, I think we would all need to respect the right of people to move to another country, hopefully under other kinds of conditions, as a condition of choice and not one of force for survival. Part of what we're doing to kind of raise awareness of the need for human rights protections for the migrant population, and especially in this era, is trying to raise the standard. Today, that's a lot represented in the UN Convention for the Protection of the Rights of Migrant Workers, passed by the UN General Assembly in 1990. Only 12 countries have ratified it. 20 are needed to bring it into force. Of course, the Western nations are very much opposed to it. It's been very slow going, but it does embody some of the particular rights of migrants that are really needed, including a definition of who is a migrant. And that definition includes those who are undocumented, undocumented, regular or irregular. It includes what's popularly called in the United States the illegals. So it's very important that we move in that direction of universalizing human rights and trying to raise the standard. I think that really has to be on the agenda for all of us, and I'd like to call upon all of you and all of us who are involved in this movement to extend a hand, not just of solidarity, but of welcome to African Americans, to other communities of color, to the foreign-born in this country, who I feel are among those most vulnerable and most impacted by the devastating effects of globalization. If anyone has a stake in challenging and fighting globalization, it is these sectors of our community. And I think as we move towards building what I would call a more colorful movement, we're also going to have a stronger movement. Thank you.
The final speaker on this panel is Colin Raja. He's the program director of Just Act, which stands for Youth Action for Global Justice. He's a native of Malaysia. He's been a youth activist for over 16 years. He's here representing the youth delegation for the A16 activities, a delegation that is cross-race, cross-class, and predominantly historically marginalized in the scheme of the globalization. So, Colin, we look forward to your remarks.
Thanks a lot, Jerry, and also I want to take this opportunity to quickly thank Victor Minotti and IFG for giving us this opportunity to voice our struggles. And thank you all for being so patient this afternoon and listening to all the different struggles that we represent. I promise then to take just about 5 more minutes of your time this afternoon. The first thing I want to do is kind of what Kathy was doing already, is to broaden what the IMF and what the World Bank represent beyond their policies and beyond the documentations and piles of structural adjustment programs that they produce. And that is, they represent a political and economic and social structure that is supported by all these policies and all this documentation, a political economic structure that predominantly oppresses the masses for the benefit of an elite, rich, and powerful people. Now, this Now, this masses, as Kathy already accurately pointed out, is predominantly people of color from working class communities, the very simple people that the World Bank and the IMF said they're supposed to be helping. I mean, these are the very people who are oppressed through these very policies and structures that they represent. Now, I personally don't know a whole lot of details about loans and structural adjustments and all that, and certainly the group that I represent too doesn't, but we can certainly feel it. In our own communities here in the U.S., in our communities around the world, we certainly feel it. And, you know, when the Washington Post, I don't know, like yesterday, a couple of days ago, was reporting World Bank officials as stating, we don't know what these demonstrators are talking about. They don't really know what happens in third world countries, and we're helping the poor for development and all that. We say, what are you talking about? We feel it. We know what it is. We represent that. That's why we're here today. That's why we're here this weekend to say enough. We call on that. We call on you. And when Michelle Camdesu says it will require a sacrifice of a generation, we say, whoa, hold on. Is a sacrifice of a couple of generations not enough? You want another one? I think one of the things we want to point out accurately that this is an oppression that's racially motivated, that's also class-based. And in fact, this structure then becomes an imperialist structure. An imperialist structure that's enforced and supported by militaries, by governments, by police, locally, around the world, communities around the world. The second thing we also want to represent and voice here today is that young people within this whole structure are very much oppressed. Youth are very much oppressed. And the one thing that we also find very oppressive is the fact that often people say this very cliched word, the cliched statement that youth are important, yeah, because youth are the future of the world. We say, no. When you say youth are the future of the world, you're actually denying young people the right to be actively participating in today's society. And in fact, around the world, young people are leading and very much a part of very many social movements very much today. And the reason is not out of intellectual reasons. It's a reason because we don't have any other choice. And I'm not talking about, you know, the young people from predominantly bigger universities and colleges where you hear a lot about. College-educated people represent only 1% of the world's population. In the U.S., you know, college-age young people, which is about 17 to 21 to 22 years old, college-age young people, out of that, only about a quarter, only about 25% are in four-year universities or colleges. Another 25% are in community colleges or two-year institutions, and another half, another 50%, are not in any kind of educational institution. They're either working, sometimes a number of jobs, or they're unemployed or they're in prison. These are the young people we're talking about that's very much affected by these structures and these policies. In California, for example, I'll just give an example from where we come from, where IFG is based also and where JustAct is based. In California, the state of California spends more on prisons than it does on education. The same around the world. Indonesia spends more on the military than it does on education. These are the kind of structures that we talk about. Cutbacks in education where young people are tracked through school into low-wage jobs so that they can support this booming economy that we're supposed to be experiencing right now. When in fact, real wages have continued to drop over the past 20 years. I come from Malaysia. The economic crisis when it hit Malaysia in 97, 98 displaced a lot of my family, a lot of my friends. My uncle, who was working driving a cab as his job, found that all of a sudden the government was raising all the taxes, raising all the license fees and everything else. At the same time, you know, people couldn't afford to take taxis very much, so his income was dropping. At the same time, his daughter, who was working in a factory, got downsized, so she was out of a job. These are the people that we're talking about. These are the people who are really feeling these effects. And young people are not just sitting back and saying, wow, we're getting all this, we're being acted upon. We are organizing actively against it. As Brent indicated, we represent a delegation, predominantly cross-race, cross-class youth from mostly around the country, but also some representatives from around the world. For example, we have a member who's representing the Asian Students Association, which has about 6-7 million members all over Asia, fighting anti-imperialist, corporate-led globalization. We also have groups that are from very local communities, from San Francisco, or from Boston area, from Chicago, who are representing a lot of the local struggles, the prison industrial complex, a lot of the police brutality that is kind of solidifying this structure, this political and economic structure. Even with our limited access, you know, we're in another church right now. We're sleeping in the basement, in a cold basement, kind of huddled together. But we're here because we find that it's important. We want to build a solidarity. And so my posing to you today is to help us be part of your movement and help make our struggle as part of your struggle and help us build a solidarity. And so I ask that we do predominantly three things, as we ourselves are doing. Is that first thing is to recognize our struggles, our communities, locally, abroad, our communities everywhere, represent what this grassroots global movement that Dennis was talking about, what this is. To represent that as we come here today, as we go out in the streets on Sunday and Monday, to represent that and show that out front, and to redefine the social and economic structure and say, no more of that. We can define a socially just economic political structure, and we want to do that. Thank you.
So I just, in summary, go back to the Iron Triangle there and consider what the speakers have said to you today. Because you've heard how the people in Guatemala were not consulted before the dam was built. In fact, they were executed. Are the migrants considered? Are the refugees considered? Is the youth considered? No. The Iron Triangle asks, what do the corporations want? And that's how the project flows if it's a World Bank project. And it flows through the country bureaucracy, working hand in glove with the corporations. And when the IMF, structural adjustment, it's going the same way. The beneficiaries are not those in need. The beneficiaries are the well-to-do, the entrenched. So keep that model in mind as you go, and really give them hell for the next 4 or 5 days.
Don't go away. We have something completely different right now. This is Essence from British Columbia.
Okay. I'm going to have to turn that mic up.